Blog Talk Radio. It's not playing.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning.
Good
this
morning.
This is Cosmic Citizen. Good morning, Phil. This is Crystalline Beek Larson with you today, with also our guest speaker, that is Pastor or Reverend Philip Gully, a very beloved American author, and also a previous guest on Cosmic Citizen. Good morning, Phil. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thanks again for being willing to come on the program and talk about your books.
Always a joy to be with you.
The last time you and James Mulholland were on, you were talking about the first two books that you wrote with him,
yes,
or co-wrote together, If Grace is True and If God is Love. And we heard then that you had another book just about to come out, which was called If the Church Were Christian.
That's right.
And I'd love for you to tell us about that publication and what gave you the impetus to start that book after the previous two.
Well, the seeds of that book were planted in the Grace book, and the reaction to it, we received much positive response from that book, which dealt with universalism. But as you can imagine, given the current religious trends, we'll say, we also received quite a few angry letters, and which made us begin to think more deeply about the church as an institution and its seeming inconsistence with the values and priorities of Jesus, and decided to delve into that a bit further. Jim, in the meantime, had switched vocations following the lead of Barack Obama. He decided to become a community organizer, and is hard at work at that in Indianapolis in the inner city, and loving that. And so it fell to me to kind of tackle this book alone. And it was a fun experience, though not as fun as if Jim had been doing it with me. But he provided some good editorial content. And what I did in that book was just take 10 topics that I thought were the focus of the church, and and kind of compared them with what we saw in the life of Jesus, insofar as we know it, which is always in a limited way, and compared them with the priorities of the modern church. And it was a fun exercise. It was a fun exercise.
Wow. So what are the 10 items or objects?
Well, let me just share them. I'll just read the chapter titles, and that'll give the listeners a sense of where the book heads. If the church were Christian, Jesus would be a model for living rather than an object of worship. If the church were Christian, affirming our potential would be more important than condemning our brokenness. Reconciliation would be valued over judgment. Gracious behavior would be more important than right belief. If the church were Christian, inviting questions would be valued more than supplying answers.
Wow, that's a great one.
I had fun with that one. Encouraging personal exploration would be more important than communal uniformity. Meeting needs would be more important than maintaining institutions. If the church were Christian, peace would be more important than power. If the church were Christian, it would care more about love and less about sex. This talks primarily about the church's and its tendency.
Obsession.
Yeah, obsession is a fine word with sexual practices, most notably these days homosexuality, and the church's poor treatment of generally poor treatment of GLBT folks. And then the last question,
and for many years still women.
Oh,
in general.
Absolutely, absolutely. And those who are divorced and just otherwise excluded from the church. And then the last chapter is, if the church were Christian, this life would be more important than the afterlife. And so in that chapter, obviously, I talk about the church's preoccupation with a heaven or hell after we die, sometimes to the exclusion of really not caring a whole lot about what happens to people here. So that was the direction of the book. It's kind of a wide-ranging book, but certainly
but
a fun,
very
fun one
pertinent.
To write. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't hard at all to find current examples of everything I was talking about. I didn't have to look very far. There were plenty of examples out there in a variety of traditions, including my own Quaker tradition, where I think Quakers have kind of missed the mark. And so that was that's also part of the book.
Well, let's go back and talk about the first question.
If
Jesus were more of a model for living,
right,
and an object of worship, as you probably know from our previous discussion, that's one of the tenets of the message that we believe has come to us from the Urantia book, is that Christianity had become more the religion about Jesus,
right,
rather than the religion of Jesus.
Correct.
And that sounds just like semantic differences.
Oh, it's a huge, it's
in
a
what
huge
you're saying.
Difference. Yeah, it's not semantic. It's really core to the Christian faith that somehow a religion that began as a means of emphasizing the teachings of a wise prophet became a religious force whose chief emphasis was worshiping that prophet. And quite frankly, from the Jesus I encounter in the Gospels and in reading other books, that seems so far removed from what the man himself would have wanted.
Yes, doesn't it, Bill?
Yeah, it's just utterly inconsistent. it's almost idolatrous. It strikes me as idolatrous, and not something at all Jesus of Nazareth, the Jewish rabbi and teacher, would have welcomed. And yet here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the religion that has done primarily that.
And it does seem to me a bit that in focusing on having Jesus as a as an object of worship, and in the core beliefs that you discussed in, you know, if grace is true and if God is love, that if the only purpose for his being here was to die for our sins, then, you know, he really didn't need to spend 3 years doing any kind of public ministry.
No, that's right. Yep.
You know, he could have just walked in, offered himself up for sacrifice, and
right.
and then, you know, virtually walked out.
Right.
After the resurrection, you know, he wouldn't have really had to stay around to say anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't have been any of the any
why
of
the why the moral
admonition.
To everybody. Yeah. That's exactly right. Well, and just the whole idea of what atonement theology ultimately leads us to, which is a vision of God who can only forgive us if someone is killed. How barbaric is that?
Right.
That theology is, and this image of Jesus as someone to be worshipped rather than followed, buys right into that atonement theology, because then Jesus has to be considered then a worthy sacrifice, and the only way that can happen is if we deify him, which is what the church did.
Mm-hmm.
Although not immediately. Gosh, it took us, you know, some 300 odd years to decide that, and even then not everyone agreed. And I go into that in the book. I kind of trace the history of how Jesus became God. And that was certainly fun to read and study.
True. And it does seem too that if we focus so much on the death and resurrection and the God that can only forgive us by the shedding of the blood of his own son, really does imply that this is a God that would be difficult to trust or love in the way we trust and love a good parent.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Well, and I think that's why we see so many people today who simply don't, who, having rejected that idea of God, believe it is the only vision of God. Believe that to be Christian is to believe those things, and so have opted out of any Judeo-Christian belief at all.
One of the things that I find that comes up a lot in discussion, debate, or something stronger that happens then that sort of turns into a argument or a face-off is that if we take away the idea of Jesus as sacrifice, then we have nothing left.
Right.
There is no reason then for us to even care about morality or ethics, because if we don't have to worry about being punished, then really what's the point?
Right. Yeah, and you hear that a lot. As if the profound teachings of Jesus in and of themselves aren't of sufficient value around which one could build a life.
Mm-hmm.
As if his only value is the fact that he had blood, physical blood, which could be spilled. I've never understood that. To me, that is just a diminishment of the true value of Jesus, which was his stunning insight into the character of God and his ability to affirm it in creative and gracious ways, in truly brave ways.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I've just never understood that. But I know it's true.
Well, I'm there with
people,
you.
I hear people say that all the time, and I understand. I hear what they're saying. I just don't understand it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I because I never really had that idea of God in the first place, mm-hmm. because I wasn't raised in a sect of Christianity that focused mm-hmm. hardly at all on the atonement.
Yeah.
And because of the influence of other resources in my family life, including the Ranch book, mm-hmm. I grew up loving Jesus, loving God,
right.
absolutely loving the testimony and the testament to
mm-hmm.
God that his life was, and
mm-hmm.
Feeling absolutely thrilled by that. And,
yeah.
you know, feeling so excited
right.
about the potential that brought with it.
Uh-huh.
That the idea that not having the focus so much on his death and the necessity for his death,
uh-huh.
you know, how that would just eliminate the need for or any interest in religion or any interest in ethical behavior
right.
really baffled me, because as a child I was somewhat rebellious and
sure we all were
during the age when I was growing up. You know, it was still, at least the early years of my growing up were still days when corporal punishment was, you know,
mm-hmm.
still the main form of behavior mod for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it didn't work for me. So,
well, it didn't always work for me either.
But, you know, I responded much more to encouragement and a sense of, you know, the sense of exploration and adventure.
Mm-hmm.
That believing in the love of God provided.
Oh yes.
You know
yeah.
that it was safe to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it might have been Gandhi who said, "What good is freedom if you know if you're not allowed to make mistakes? The
yeah.
you know the real benefit of freedom." And the only type of freedom that we should ever want is the kind of freedom that allows for people to make mistakes.
Right, which is the same freedom that allows us the freedom to choose. As opposed to religious life that is centered around compulsion and must and oughts, which it seems to me in my experience never have the power to deeply transform us. They
right.
only have the power to scare us in
mm-hmm.
a certain direction, and I would argue that that isn't ultimately either ultimately gracious or ultimately helpful or transformative. Yeah.
And not particularly inspiring.
No, it isn't at all. It isn't at all.
I don't understand how awe-inspiring and fear-inspiring can be seen as the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a bit about the first of the 10 points then. You had said that really the church should be focusing more on our potential
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
than condemning.
Yeah, affirming our potential rather than condemning our brokenness.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, I bring up that most curious of Christian theologies, the concept of the original sin, which presupposes, among other things, that Adam and Eve were actual, real persons who found themselves, because of their innate human curiosity, wanting to dine from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, suddenly find themselves, and not just themselves, but all who would follow after them, condemned just by virtue of their humanity. And this is
or condemned by curiosity.
Condemned by curiosity, which I've always thought was a wonderful spiritual feature and should be encouraged, not discouraged.
Yeah.
And I grew up in that.
Children.
Yeah. Being growing up Roman Catholic, I was just steeped in this. And I thought when I became a Quaker that would end, but I discovered that the branch of Quakers that I was in were just as passionate about that, and it mystified me. I thought, what is there about that makes any sense? And to be sure, this isn't a denial of the human propensity to not be all we can be, to fail at times and to disappoint, but this notion that we are by virtue of our birth and by virtue of something done by two people who never lived somehow condemned to hell for that is just preposterous. Once I began thinking about it, it just simply never made sense, and quite frankly, still doesn't. And so this book kind of tackles that: why the church ever decided that this would be an appropriate view of humanity is a mystery to me. But there you have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And then on point number two, encouraging peace over power.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the gist of that, if I understand it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of power do you believe that the majority of Christian churches were looking for? And
well,
I say were looking because I do also think that we're finding quite a bit of transition or change going on.
Yeah.
And there are certainly some churches that really don't believe that anymore, but seem to be left with a bit of confusion about where to go from here.
Right. Well, I think the church is, over its history has tried to accumulate various forms of power. The first, I would say, the power inherent in moral authority. That is, the church has been able to convince itself and others that it alone has the right to discern what is morally and spiritually appropriate for the rest of us. And with that comes a certain authority, a certain power, because they are now they have been historically the sole arbiter of what is good and what is just and what is appropriate. And that power endures as long as your morality endures. And I think this is why the church has lost this power, because it is clear with the sexual abuse cases in the Roman Catholic Church, with the scandals of prominent televangelists, with its comfortable alliance with the rich and powerful, that the church no longer has a unique claim on moral authority. We have simply lost the right to posit ourselves as the authoritative voice for morality. We simply can't do that. And with that, I think has come a real loss of power, which I think is good, because I think such power tended to make us arrogant.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Right. So I don't mourn this at all. I do mourn the moral failures. I don't mourn the sense of arrogance and the unwarranted pride that many of us in the church felt. That was something we needed to be rid of, and that appears to be happening. I don't think
to knock down a notch.
Pardon me? Yeah.
To get knocked down a notch.
Right. Which I think is can be very redemptive, and might teach the church to be a bit more open, a bit more forgiving, a bit less critical, which I think in the end will accrue to the benefit of the church, and not to its detriment. So there's that loss of power, and there's also it's also clear that when you study, particularly the history of American Christianity, the Christianity's alliance with the American way, particularly in times of war, has been most unfortunate, and it's caused us at critical times in the nation's history and in the church's history to support activities of our government and nation that were inappropriate. And instead of being a prophetic voice calling the nation to justice and peace and reconciliation, we have too often been almost the hired spokesperson for a nation gone astray.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that's certainly something our forefathers would have felt pretty uncomfortable about.
Well, yeah, I think that was probably as much as any other reason this whole idea of separation of church and state came about, not just to protect the state from overreaching religion, but maybe also because they sensed that religion at its best would be prophetic, would be humble and prophetic, and not so closely allied with secular power, that power then bleeded over into religious power.
Does seem to have been, I mean, I know you're saying that it seems more obvious in your study of American Christianity, but certainly, papal power over kings, queens, and princes, over the history of, much of the West altogether. And I don't think that Christianity is alone.
Oh gosh, no.
In that, right? I mean, it seems like many of the Semitic religions, anyway, do really seem to want political power to go hand in hand with religious authority.
Yeah, that's right. We see it now in the struggle in Turkey and Saudi Arabia with Islam and Judaism and Israel. Yeah.
And between Catholic and Protestant in Ireland.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, we don't have to look far.
And within our own society, too, with many of the legal schisms that divide us politically seem to fall in line with a lot of religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with acknowledging the sovereignty of God in a nation.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem to me to be outside of separating church and state, because I don't equate God with church.
Right.
You know, I think God at the very least has to be bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. It, I guess my only reservation is it depends on who gets to define who gets to define God, and what role will they have in the nation? That's when I always kind of start looking sideways to make sure nobody's chasing after me.
Right. I heard an interesting point made online this last week. We had a somewhat of a moral debate going on over a question, and one gentleman mentioned that a rabbi he had spoken to when he was younger said, you know, all of the religions on earth, all of the major religions on earth, seem to be in conflict over their concept of God, their description of God,
mm-hmm.
and the attributes that they're willing to bestow upon God
right.
or believe in about God.
Right.
But surprisingly, they all seem to agree on what kind of character or disposition makes up a godly man.
Mm-hmm. Well, and maybe that will be...
I found that a really interesting question to ponder.
And maybe that will be the start of of some kind of universal religion down the road. In fact, I argue in the book that I'm working on now called The Next Christianity that should be the role of the future church to help reconcile all the world's religions into one, into at least a group of people who vow to honor the divine expressions of others. Rather than kill and fight over them.
Well, and Jesus definitely said, you know, by their fruits you shall know them.
Right. Right.
And he does, you know, go into some detail in defining what those fruits are.
Mm-hmm.
And we very rarely argue over that.
No, we don't. Oh, love, joy, peace, patience. Boy, who isn't
right.
for that?
All right. Especially for me, you know. Maybe
yeah.
not for my enemy, but definitely for me. Well, let's move on then and talk about your next point, that
uh-huh.
the church should be more interested, more focused on love
uh-huh.
and less about sexuality or sex.
Yeah.
How did you come to believe that?
This has been born out of my experience as a pastor that I've never seen people in the church so agitated as when they suspect someone is violating the sexual code, whether it's people living together who aren't married, whether it's gay people or lesbians, transgendered, bisexual folks. It just seems to me that for too long the church has sat around being anxious about whether or not people are having appropriate types of sex and who with. And I think the church should just get out of the sex business. It brings out the absolute worst in us, our judgmental side. What the church ought to be doing, since it's clear that Christians have no monopoly on good marriages. In fact, I say in the book, I was doing some research and came across a very interesting study that young couples who identified themselves as atheists or agnostics had a lower divorce rate than those couples who defined themselves as Christians.
Hmm.
And more specifically, conservative Christians. And so I just tongue-in-cheek said that if I were going to offer a young couple marital advice, it would be to become atheists as quickly as they could. Because they have found something. I don't know what it is. Perhaps it's the reliance on reason and human reason and human ability to solve their problems. Perhaps a bit quicker to engage one another if they sense a problem. I don't know why that reason, and the survey didn't say. but it just seems to me that the church has not done an adequate job itself of modeling appropriate relational and sexual behavior. And I think it's because we've been emphasizing the activity of sex as opposed to the practice of love, which I define in the book as our commitment to the growth of the beloved.
Right, exactly.
And that's what the church ought to be concerned about, is teaching one another how to work for the growth of those we love. And if we do that, then our marriages will be better, all our relationships will be better if we're concentrating on helping those we love grow. And we're not doing that now. We're not doing that.
That's something that's really a passion of mine, is sort of putting together a workshop or a seminar presentation on how do you learn to love? What are the essential habit patterns or reaction patterns that we need to put in place in our own lives in order to, A, sort of model a level of tolerant self-control, and B, to effectively be more concerned about the needs of another and be willing to give others the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And to find a way to refuse to become offended in the first place, so we don't have to spend so much time struggling with forgiveness.
Right.
There just seems to be a real need to develop, learn, share, and practice those types of skills.
Yes.
Not necessarily just with, you know, people we run into on the line in the supermarket, but how we deal with people in our own family, our parents, our children, our brothers, our sisters, you know, the people in our own neighborhoods.
And boy, it seems unfair, but it also seems to be true that some people in this life have a leg up on others, and I think it generally has to do with their parents and how they were treated as young people. I've often thought that if there was an all-powerful, all-knowing deity, then why he or she didn't alter the way humans were born is a mystery to me. Why some people are allowed to have children and others not is a profound mystery to me. But you just wish, you don't have to live long before you find yourself deeply wishing that every child who comes in the world could know what it is to be deeply loved.
To be deeply loved.
Yeah.
So true.
Because it makes it so much easier to then love deeply those who...
And really make our... the focus of our citizenship, if you will, more about the value of a life following birth, as opposed to just focusing on making absolutely sure every baby that's conceived gets born.
Right. Yeah.
How does morality somehow stop at the point of birth? Why is it all right for us to abuse tiny children or to isolate them from the kind of nurturing love that they so obviously need and that their very lives depend on it?
Yeah. I remember when Bill Clinton was president and Hillary Clinton had that coined that, quoted that African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. Now, that was met with such derision. And by some folks, but
was it?
To me, it's just obviously true that because so many parents have failed their children, and even those parents who haven't, everyone still needs others outside their family who love them, who teach them, who engage them. It just takes all of us working together to do that. And I think the church is wonderfully poised to do that, but we have become so distracted over other things, worrying about.
And how do you see that?
Well, again, our preoccupation with what we define to be moral expressions of love, so that if someone is gay or lesbian, the church for far too many years has just said they just don't understand what it means to love, and they're.
What I mean is, what my question was, what I meant by that was, how do you see that the church is poised?
Well, it seems to me that the church, despite its loss of power, still has among many people enjoys a certain status. It isn't like it used to be, clearly not. But that isn't to say that the church doesn't still have some regard. For instance, when most people get married, they come to the church to do it. Now, that's changing, but I still do a lot of weddings for people who don't have a church home. But when it comes time to get married and when it comes time to think about relationships, there's something in them that still looks naturally to a spiritual community to help provide some insider guidance. And I think if the church wished, it could take advantage of this reflex. We'll call it a reflex, because it is almost reflexive, that most people don't even think about it. They just think they have to involve the church if they're going to get married. We would take advantage of this and really begin to talk to people deeply, people who are getting married, people who are
about great. Like premarital counseling or how to balance expectations,
well,
those kinds of
well,
things.
Well, really about what it means to love deeply, so that how we understood love could be taken and considered wholly apart from one's sexual orientation, so that by the end of a discussion or a series of discussions with a spiritual leader, people could understand that other people who are not like them nevertheless love as deeply as they do, and we need to respect that and acknowledge that. It becomes a wonderful opportunity to really educate people, and we do this in our meeting, in the Quaker meeting I pastor. When we recognize children when they're born, we don't baptize, but we do like to acknowledge that the child is here, and that becomes a wonderful opportunity to then talk with the parents and the congregation about what does it mean when we take a child into our midst and care for that child. So it seems to me that, for good or ill, our society has said and looks to the church to provide some meaning at significant moments in our lives, and that we should take fuller advantage of that, and we haven't always done that.
Hmm. It's very, very true.
It might be one of the reasons why so many people now find the church to be irrelevant, because instead of getting a spiritual education and taught not what to think but how to think,
mm-hmm.
We've given them instead indoctrination.
I think that's very true.
Yeah.
And we know that just in terms of educational systems, indoctrinating children in school about, you know, a certain, like, for example, learning by rote, mm-hmm. instead of learning how to question and how to think and how to research.
Right.
You know, those are really teaching kids the skills that they need to be able to discover or determine problem solving in their future lives.
So that we learn that education.
Memorizing a poem or a piece of legal doctrine does not necessarily help us implement that same doctrine later in life.
That education is more than regurgitation.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's really the effort to do sustained.
I might be digressing here a bit, but my parents, I don't know if you remember that, they were medical missionaries in West
mm-hmm.
Africa. And my dad was often the only doctor and for, you know, many square miles and covering a population group that was over a couple hundred thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're the only doctor at a hospital and when you have more patients than any one doctor possibly could see in a day.
Yeah.
The nursing school had to be able to turn out nurses
mm-hmm.
who within a very short period of time, you know, barely with a secondary education, definitely no pre-med in college.
Right.
Were going to have to be able to perform many of the tasks that doctors would do
mm-hmm.
in this culture.
Right.
And he said, you know, all of them had been taught by rote. All of them had learned to simply regurgitate information.
Mm-hmm.
And in the situation in which they found themselves now, that was simply not going to be an effective way of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said that one of the things he noticed was that they, in that culture, they were also punished severely for making mistakes.
Yeah.
And he said, being afraid of making mistakes in medicine is no more effective than being afraid of making mistakes in religion.
Uh-huh.
That you have to not only be able to make mistakes, but to be able to learn from those mistakes and learn for, let's say, your whole class.
Right.
And if you can't open up about the mistake you've made and clearly analyze where you went wrong and what you could have done better,
mm-hmm.
If you can't bring it out in the open, you can't mm-hmm. admit it and discuss it with the group.
Yeah.
And utilize group wisdom about, you know, how could I have done this better? What would have saved this life? Or what would have stopped that infection? Or what can we do to decrease infant mortality, increase
mm-hmm.
the number of children that live past the age of two? What can we do better?
Yeah.
So he had to institute a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Which was that making mistakes was good.
Right.
And not making them intentionally.
Right.
But by believing that you're going to do the very best thing and having it not work out.
Right. Well, how many light bulbs did Edison have to invent before he found the right one?
Exactly. And he said, you know, in medicine, when you're trying to teach young people how to take responsibility, they have to gain self-respect and self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And that can only be done when they're not being punished for admitting their mistakes. And
right.
he instituted a system whereby when somebody would make a mistake, they would be rewarded for bringing it to the group and saying, hey, I made this mistake. Let's look at it. Let's talk about it. Let's learn from it.
Oh, just think if the church did that.
Right, and just think if our educational system did that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Or our political system.
Right.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
I posted that recently on a discussion board with a young man, very spiritually lit young man, who I'm I'm really becoming so fond of, because he's got just such an amazing mind. And he was berating himself for having made this mistake or a series of mistakes. And I posited the question, well, what would it be like if you were being educated in a system that rewarded you for acknowledging mistakes and sharing them? And he thought I was being sarcastic. And then I sort of illustrated it further.
Well, that's how alien the idea is to us.
Right. And he says, oh, my gosh, I've never even considered thinking that way.
Yeah.
And, wow, that could really turn things around significantly.
Oh, yes, it could.
But anyway.
Oh, my.
I'll end that with just saying that one of the benefits of having been through that system of sort of rewarding people for trial and error and learning from those mistakes. And the benefit of sharing was that now not everyone has to learn only by leaping.
Uh-huh.
They can also learn, they can have the benefit of your experience as well as their own.
Yeah.
If you're not too embarrassed to share.
Yeah.
And the one of the benefits of that was that some of the nurses that passed through that training program there later on became major leaders in the health department throughout that, you know, burgeoning
region.
Nation.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, what a wonderful approach that could be for so many. I mean, look what we do in our political world. If someone makes a mistake, they're
right.
gone. Yeah.
Right. Heads yeah. will roll.
What's the old saying by Abraham Lincoln? Success is a poor teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wisdom we learn from our mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that happens to bring us a fairly good segue into the next of your 10 points, which is being more preoccupied with hell, or that the church has been. Some churches
yeah.
have been more preoccupied with hell.
Yeah, the afterlife.
And heaven.
Right.
The afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
Than with life here.
Right. The very
How can we successfully prove Jesus' statement that the kingdom of heaven is within us, or the kingdom of heaven is at hand? I mean, what did he mean?
Well, and my thought in this chapter and the evidence I use is that we spend way too much time talking about an afterlife no one living has ever experienced. And so it's all conjecture. At some point, we have to begin to wonder if it isn't wishful thinking. I mean, when you hear most descriptions of heaven, it's pretty nice.
Well, I don't know about that. Some of it sounds pretty strange to me.
Well, yeah, that's true. I've streets of gold and playing on harps. That
I mean,
I take much harp music myself.
Well, right, and you know, I'm the type of person who, you know, that kind of thing would get pretty boring pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And one of my ideals of hell would be just being that bored.
I love the old Madeline Lingle story that she tells. That Madeline Lingle, a wonderful writer and Christian thinker, and she tells this story about a man dying and going to heaven, and he meets St. Peter, and he's ushered in, and he looks around, and heaven's all beautiful, and he says, it's beautiful, and I'm glad I'm here, but I'm curious. Why am I the only one here? Where are all the saints?" And St. Peter says, "Oh, the saints are in hell ministering to the damned." And that was the story that initially made me think about our emphasis on the afterlife and how really, in some ways, and I can understand it if somebody's had a miserable, rotten life here, why the appeal of heaven might be so great. But quite frankly, for a number of us, we haven't had that kind of life, and to to sit around and structure our life so that at the end of it we get even more blessing seems to me to be rather self-absorbed. And
well, I'll share with you, if you'll humor me, one of the things that I found absolutely the most beneficial in the vivid detail about life after death and the ascension plan and the whole sort of universe educational system, if you will, that it describes as being this sort of continual growth, continual rehabilitation, continual service, learning, teaching what we have just learned to those right behind us.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's really this sort of almost eternal quest to gain spiritual perfection,
right,
in one's own personality and character, and then a fusion that occurs between oneself and that voice of God within.
Mm-hmm.
And that the whole purpose is this experiential learning program,
mm-hmm,
that is mercy dominated.
Right.
And that kind of very much like the same type of, you know, childhood education or treatment of humane treatment of children that we were just talking about before.
Yeah.
They're sort of referring to us still, mm-hmm, as sort of universe children, you know, barely out of infancy by,
mm-hmm,
the time we die.
Mm-hmm.
And but one of the things it says is that we really gain nothing from that transition, from the experience of waking up from death,
mm-hmm,
other than the realization that we've woken up.
Right.
And but pretty much, other than that, we're pretty much starting off there where we left off here.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever problems we were dealing with, whatever character issues or personality problems we were faced with, are not going to be eliminated.
Magically gone. Yeah.
We might have a better remediation program.
Right. My hope
better,
is to have more hair.
Better therapists.
My hope is to have more hair. That's what I would like. I'll become a strong advocate of an afterlife if it involves me gaining my hair back.
Well, and for me, I'm really looking forward to having a body that works, you know, the way it used to when I was a teenager.
Yes, that would be nice,
know,
too.
Having joints that didn't ache. But
well,
one of the other very interesting points, and one that's kind of strange to contemplate, is that it says that we will no longer have the luxury or the handicap,
mm-hmm,
of being able to procrastinate.
Right.
That, you know, procrastinating will no longer be possible. And it's like, I can't wrap my brain around that idea. But sometimes when I want to put myself to sleep, I start, you know, considering that problem.
That possibility,
you know,
yeah.
It becomes so overwhelming that my eyelids get heavy. But anyway, moving along. Yet I digress. What
do you think we
should be focusing on more than the afterlife?
Yes. There are plenty enough challenges in this life that need our attention. We'll let the next life take care of itself if there is one.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, you were talking about the things that you felt that, you know, were the kinds of things we should be focusing on, which was something to do with reconciliation, gracious,
mm-hmm,
behavior,
mm-hmm,
more.
Obviously.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, obviously something focusing our attention on just the huge disparity in our that exists in our world. I mean, when we look about us and are honest with ourselves and ask ourselves, would I want to be born into the situation that these people find themselves in? And if we say no to that, then that to me becomes a good guide as to where we should be putting our attention. Would I want to be born a woman under Sharia law?
Mm-hmm.
Would I want to be born a child in the slums of Calcutta?
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't. Well, then what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that if the church were to have that as our measure stick and really our guide to what our priority should be, that would keep us sufficiently busy and engaged.
How to really make us accept a doctrine of service and
right.
and
right.
fellowship.
Because it's clear that when we look at the world that desperately needs to happen. That it truly isn't a lack of resources. It's a lack of creative imagination and empathy for those who suffer. And that we need to deal with that more constructively than what we have.
And how do you think that Jesus' life example, if we were going to focus more on his example than on worshiping him,
well,
what do you think?
I spoke about this just last Sunday at my meeting, this marvelous little story of the man with the withered hand. Jesus enters a synagogue, and there's this guy with a withered hand. Two things were going on then. One, it meant that the guy was really had a glaring inability to provide for himself and his family because he was crippled. And two, he was crippled in an age when people understood that to be God's judgment, that this man had done
right.
something.
That's what, you were getting punished for something.
Yeah, you were getting punished for something. And Jesus wants to heal him, but it's a Sabbath, and healing is considered work.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus just poses this wonderful question, inviting people to imagine. And when he posed that, really it's a delightfully humorous question. If you had a lamb that fell into the well, would you wait until the next day? You know, if it fell into the well on the Sabbath, would you wait until the next day to pull it out? Of course not. And how much more valuable is a human being than a lamb?
Mm-hmm.
And he heals the man, and it upsets people, of course, because grace, there are always a number of people upset by grace. And
that is so true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
How upsetting grace can be.
But just this invitation, this knack that he had for inviting people to place themselves in another's position and ask, how would you feel?
And doesn't he say something to the point, was man designed for the Sabbath, or was Sabbath designed for man?
Yeah. What's the purpose of this, folks? It was to help you, not to
give you a day off for some R&R.
Well, and to do good. It was meant to bless mm-hmm. you, not to be yet another law bound around your neck so that you couldn't even do good on that day. Yeah. Really a profound lesson. Yeah.
And you said something in conclusion about, you know, if we don't really start getting these things,
right.
these particular things in line or at a higher, but more of the top of the priority list, how does the church continue to be relevant?
Well, it won't. And other movements, other spiritual movements which do, provide a more meaningful orientation to life will begin to overshadow us. And that's fine. That's fine. If Christianity, if we're not doing our job, then it should. We tend to think that because God is eternal, so are the religious institutions which focus on God. And that isn't true. They come and go.
And they change and evolve and
that's right.
transform.
The worship of Baal was once a pretty significant movement in the Middle East. It no longer is. And I think the day might come when the same is said for Christianity. But it seems to me those religious and spiritual movements which help people grow and equip us to love deeply and to empathize and care and provide wisdom and guidance will continue to be meaningful to people and will continue to not only endure but to flourish. And those religions which don't, won't. They just won't make it because people won't see them as real viable alternatives for their lives. So I think in that sense, the church is at a crossroads. And that's probably good. Maybe it'll make us, maybe that will inspire us to grow. And
We had a guest on several months ago by the name of Phyllis Tickle. She's
I know Phyllis.
Theologian. Do you know her?
Oh, yeah.
She yeah, and, you know, she asks, you know, some of those questions. And, and her observation is the church pretty much completely reforms itself about once every 500 years.
Yeah, yeah, and we're doing it right now.
And we're doing it right now when we have been for the last century. And,
right.
You know, we don't know where we're going to end up, but we do need to be aware that we're going to succeed in transforming ourselves or we're going to be totally irrelevant and we'll die out.
It's exciting when you think about it. It's an exciting time to be in the church. It's an exciting time to be alive. It really is. It really is fun. And,
so, speaking of that transformation, what does the new Christianity look like? Or I believe you're working on, or almost finished with.
Yeah.
The next Christianity.
Well, I think it will be integrative. That is, I think it's going to take the best from each tradition. It will have what I call in the book porous boundaries. It will feel very free to take and incorporate the best of other religious traditions.
Oh, I like that.
And as Jesus did, it's interesting.
Didn't he?
So many times when you read the Gospels, Jesus' example of spiritual health were taken from people outside his own religious tradition. When he was talking about faith, he cited the faith of a Roman centurion, you know, a pagan, for God's sake. And he said, this man understands what it means to be faithful. When he was looking for a definition of what it meant to be a good neighbor, he talked about a Samaritan, outside his own tradition. So I'm saying if this is our namesake, if this is the guy who was our religion's namesake, if he's doing that, then shouldn't
he's promoting
we also,
it.
Yeah.
Right.
Then
he's
shouldn't
looking
we
for
also,
the truth.
So I suspect that the church of the future, if it's going to be successful, is going to have porous borders. It's going to be able to see the good no matter where it is and lift it up. And affirm it and bring it into the Jesus story. It will feel quite free to share the Jesus story with other traditions and people of other traditions, but it will not dogmatically insist that it is the only way. For having porous borders, it will also have an open mind and a willingness to see the good in other movements. I think that's going to be the key factor in the next Christianity, and I can't wait for that to happen. It's long overdue.
Well, I think it is happening within some of the interfaith movements and within some of the integrative philosophies.
Right, right.
I don't know if you've ever looked at any of the other sort of biographies of any of the other guests that we have on this program, but there's one I'd really like to recommend to you is Steve McIntosh, who wrote a book about not emergence, but integrative philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact on evolution of in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite a deep, thought-provoking philosophy. And I think he deviates in some ways of some of the other leaders in the integrative movement. But some of what he has to say is really quite profound.
Yeah.
If you get a chance, look at Steve McIntosh.
Steve McIntosh, I'm writing that down. You know, and one thing, and a book that has lately really caught my interest is Harvey Cox, who's retired now from Harvard Divinity School, who wrote a wonderful book that just came out. It's called The Future of Fate. And it is a wonderful, wonderful book. And in that book, Cox argues that the church has gone through three periods. It's entering the third period now. We're right in that transition moment. And the first period was the age of faith, and this was for about the first 300 years when the example of Jesus was still pretty fresh in the minds of people.
And you where know, people were willing to die for it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was very much a countercultural movement. And then when with Constantine making it the state religion, we entered into what Cox calls the age of belief, where believing the right things about Jesus is what it means to be Christian, and that we've been in that now for, 1,700 years. But we're slowly moving out of that, he believes, into what he calls the age of the Spirit. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful book, The Future of Faith by Harvey Cox. So I encourage everyone to look that up. Well, my light is flashing here, which means I have another obligation to hurry off to, but I sure do appreciate you having me on your program.
Well, I do too, and I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk more about the book you're just about to finish.
Well, it'll be out next summer, and maybe we can visit again and talk about it at length.
Well, it would be a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much.
I would enjoy that. Thanks for having me on.
Have a wonderful weekend.
You too, friend.
Thank
Bye-bye
you.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.
Referring to the story of the garden where Adam and Eve are walking around the garden enjoying this paradise. They're naked, but they don't recognize their nakedness. And in fact, they're not alone in the garden, along with the animals and everything else. God is also present in the garden, and they actually have conversations with him. And it's through one of those conversations that they learn they should not eat from the tree of knowledge. But Snake convinces Eve to, in fact, take a bite out of the apple, which she does, and she passes it on to Adam, and he does as well. And so our little story of the garden are in our story of the garden, we learn that that caused displeasure to God, who kicked Adam and Eve out, and that is the so-called fall from grace, and original sin is associated with that fall.
Right.
Oh, I just heard somebody speak in my ear. Is that you, Crystalline?
It is.
Okay, so I just started talking because we've got another 25 minutes here, and I just thought, since I'm on air, I'll get on my soapbox and continue. But this
yeah,
is,
I heard you.
Yeah, this is the last theme that Philip listed as being the subject of his book, if you recall from the list of things he mentioned. And it's this theme that is very much at the heart of our Western tradition, and very much defines the sort of unease that I had as a youngster, the unease that triggered my own sort of spiritual journey, my own quest. And it's this whole notion of fall from grace, of being kicked out of the garden into the world as we know it, the world of nature, a world that is inherently evil, or so we think, that any natural impulse we have is really an occasion for sin. You know, if we eat too much, we're gluttons. If we want too much, we're greedy.
Selfish, right.
Selfish, yeah. If we take pleasure in the flesh, we're lustful and sinful. And the long and short of it is, we're not going to enter a state of grace in this world of nature unless we are redeemed, unless we are made once again at one with God, the notion of atonement. So this is the Western tradition. It's one that does not affirm life the way the Eastern tradition does.
Mm-hmm.
In our tradition, we see ourselves as being apart from God, right? When we ate the apple and were expelled from the garden, we ceased to be in the presence of God. We used to chat with him in the garden, and now we don't. That somehow God
is... He doesn't talk to us anymore because he's mad.
Exactly. Yeah, that's our perception now.
Mm-hmm.
Understand this. This is our understanding. And so we hold God way out there. And because we hold God way out there, we don't recognize that he is in us and that we are in him.
Right.
And I understood Philip to say this was one of the themes in his book. And that's when I began posting the comments to the board that you and I later had a chat about and tried to see did they connect with what our guest was speaking of. My feeling was that they did, but I guess I didn't make the connection clear enough because you asked me to clarify that. And I guess I felt I was speaking out of turn, so I decided that I would just put an end to it.
Well, it wasn't that you were speaking out of turn. It was just it was a bit opaque to me.
Right. Okay.
You know?
Well, hopefully I've added clarity to it in the last couple of minutes. I don't know if I have or not. But
there's also some music or something going on in the background.
Oh, yes, that's my ambient noise. I just turned it off, so that should be
okay.
Better, I think. And
yes, much.
Do you hear the roar of my air conditioner? I can turn that off, too.
No, that's fine.
Okay. So... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So I was about to say that this show was very timely because I've just finished listening to the interviews Bill Moyers had with Joseph Campbell back in, I think it was around 1988. It was one of those PBS presentations
mm-hmm.
that were used to try and encourage people to become members of public broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever saw them.
I saw a few of them. I just didn't listen that long
okay.
because for me, Joseph Campbell was just sort of hard to listen to.
That's really interesting you say that because, I have a long story about my quest, and it started as a consequence of confirmation classes in the church, and currently is finding a lot of joy in the message of the Urantia book.
Mm-hmm.
But between then, when I was 12-ish or so, and now, and I won't disclose how ancient I am, along the way I ended up in the Navy. And while I was in the Navy, I stumbled across a book that Campbell had written. It was one of a series of four books on what he called the Masks of God, and it was his study of mythology.
Right. I have read some of that.
Okay. Well, when that book fell in my life, into my hands, it was just something that so resonated with where I was that I literally devoured it and then went out and got the other three volumes and read them, and so felt very comfortable with the ideas that Campbell was expressing. And the same thing happened when I, finally decided to read the Urantia book. The message it conveyed to me was just, I was so ready to receive it that I devoured that as well. You know, circumstances made it possible for me to literally take 3 weeks out of my life and do nothing else but read the book. My meals were brought to me. My day-to-day needs were taken care of. I was in a hotel room, shut off from the world, and all I had was the Urantia book. And I started reading it, and 3 weeks later I finished reading it. And within about 5 minutes of finishing my reading, there was a knock on my hotel room door, and I was invited back to the world, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just...
Very timely indeed.
Exactly. You know, the Urantia book tells us there's no coincidences or no accidents or whatever. And I certainly I'm a testament to that in some of the things that have happened in my life. You know, like having Campbell stumble into my hands when I was in the Navy, and having 3 weeks made available to me when I had the book to read, and so on it goes.
Wow, yeah.
But to connect this to the subject of Cosmic Citizen today, Joseph Campbell, in the second hour of the series of conversations he had with Bill Moyers, spoke of the fact that he had the opportunity to speak to an Indian wise man somewhere in India. I'm not sure where it was. And he tells the story of his encounter with this wise man who had, you know, the name he was given as a child, but the name he adopted as a guru in Indian context. And his adopted name was Atman Anda. So Atman is a perception of being that is very much part of the Indian tradition.
The enlightenment stage.
Exactly. And Nanda is like, I don't know how to...
Ananda is sort of like a respectful title or ending, like
right.
that you would utilize
like
a wise
professor
man or
so-and-so.
Father, right.
Yeah. So that was
or
his...
like San in Japanese.
Exactly. San in Japanese. Exactly. It's an honorific. That's it.
Right.
Thanks for helping me with that. So the name he went by as a sage, an Indian sage, was Atmananda. Anyway, Campbell is introduced to this gentleman, and the gentleman says, "Do you have a question for me?" And Campbell takes a moment to explain that Indian sages don't offer information, don't tell you things. Instead, they answer your questions. So that was Campbell's experience. Atmananda said, "Do you have a question for me?" So Campbell asked him the question. He said, you know, if divinity is present in creation, how can we say no to the world? And Atmananda looked at him and he said, by way of answer, for you, Joseph, and for me, we must say yes. So Campbell elaborates on this, and he says, what he was talking about is, if divinity is present in creation, which is the Eastern perception, and is not our perception. Again, I refer you to the Garden of Eden story, where we are expelled from the garden. When we were in the garden, we were inside a divine world. And
or
then when we
like a divine connectivity.
Yeah, we are connected with God. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The Creator recognizes that He is in creation and is in the creature. And just as the Creator is in the creature, so the creature is in the Creator. Right? And that's the notion of personality in the Urantia book. Right? The very first gift we are given once we become self-aware is the gift of personality, which is God stuff. The first person of deity is personality, the sine qua non of personality. And when a creature becomes self-aware, the very first thing he's given is personality, a gift from the Father. And he uses that personality to begin his ascension journey. I think that's just amazing myself. But anyway, so Campbell explains what he means when he says you have to say yes. If the divine is in creation, then we have no right to judge good from bad, because the divine is neither good nor bad. Good and bad, this notion of duality, are human ideas. And they're very real for us. I mean, I'm not saying they're not real to us. I mean, we see badness all the time. We should not be repelled by it. We should not despise it. We should not feel guilt for it. It's part of life, and we need to revel in life. That's his message, that we need to revel in the experience of life. And that, again, is the message of the Urantia book. I mean, how does God, the I Am, that philosophic conception, how does he enter time and space as the Supreme? Well, he does that through a process of eventuation. And what is eventuation? It is the summation of experience. Once all experience is experienced, when there's no more experience to experience, right? When experience is replete and complete, then the Supreme eventuates. So the message is, we need to revel in life. We need to experience life. We need to involve ourselves in life, because that is where the divine is. So I mentioned again in the chat room that eternity has nothing to do with time.
Right.
You can't measure it in time. Eternity is like the philosophic conception, I am. You know, it's beyond our understanding. It's beyond our words. And our words are time-oriented. That's why it has nothing to do with time. But somehow, time intersects eternity. And the intersection is the here and now. The intersection is the experience we bring to life's adventure. So,
okay.
That is what allows the becoming aware. Again, the Urantia book tells us that the I Am, as the unqualified absolute, is somehow fettered in eternity, bound up by infinity. And it's not until the qualifications emerge, the unqualified moves into the qualified absolute, that time and space, creation comes into being, that relation comes into being. That's the message. So that's the message of the Urantia book. That's the message that all religious tradition tries to express. Because religion, look at it etymologically. Religion is religio, making the link again. The link got broken when we were expelled from the garden, and what we want to do is reconnect. That's religio. That's religion. That's what religion is for. So the very best thought we can have is a thought we can't have. because it transcends thought. You know, we talk about God, but do we know what we talk about? We don't. We have a sense of what we're trying to talk about, but it's transcendent. And
right.
We
can have a relationship without
yes.
knowing everything there is
exactly.
to know about that personality.
Yes.
You
so
start,
the very... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you start with the intention of having the relationship.
And why do we have that intention? We have that intention.
We crave it.
Why do we crave it?
To not be alone.
Well, yes, but where does this feeling of being alone come from?
Well, if as the Urantia book says, the whole reason for the Trinity and then creation coming into being was the desire for deity not to be alone.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
That's a simplification of that.
It's a root cause. Yeah, it's a simplification, but it is our best effort to put into words this transcendental understanding we have. And why do we have it? We have it because being a self-aware creature, being a creature of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
the first person of deity bestows on us the first person of deity.
Right.
Personality.
Right.
And then just to be doubly sure that we become aware, he bestows on us something else, something that is pre-personal, that wants to become personal. And what is that?
I'm not sure.
What is
sure
the second bestowal?
Spirit.
Not quite.
Okay.
What is the second gift from the Father that we receive once we make a moral choice that aligns with the divine plan?
A thought adjuster.
There you go.
Which is what I meant by spirit.
Okay. Okay.
It's a pre-personal fragment of God.
Exactly.
But,
and the first gift
is a personal
instance of God, and we don't give that first gift its due. I'm not sure why, but we don't give it its due.
Well, we don't because we don't understand it. I mean, I guess for me, the way I think of that process, it's like the best I can give to you is the realest part of me, the most real part of me.
That's right.
If we are going to engage in relationship, if our intention, if the initial spark is the intention, the will, the choice to have a moral choosing, and the best choice that I can make is to connect with the most real part of me. If I'm superficial, or I'm partial, or I'm uncommitted, or incomplete, then I just give you a rudimentary greeting. But this is a very different level of reality, because this is deity giving us the very best he can give us.
If that
makes sense.
Yeah, that is so true. That is so true. And the whole reason I jumped on my soapbox in the chat room at the outset of Philip's talk was the very fact that he was pointing that out. When he spoke to his final theme, the one after the theme that addresses the fact that we really have to focus on the message of Jesus, not the person of Jesus, then he spoke to this notion of the divine being present in creation. And that's the thing. The divine is present in creation. And how is it present? It's the divine is present in creation by virtue of the bestowal of personality upon self-aware creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the purpose of that? The purpose is to further self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's an exploration.
Exactly. Our journey, our ascension journey. The end goal is to attain divinity. The Urantia book says that explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
When we reach our journey's end as a finaliter, we attain the divinity potential that has been in us from the get-go.
Right. We become perfect even as he is perfect.
Exactly. We recognize what personality is. That first gift, and I call it an instance of personality, when it is bestowed, without awareness. It does
mm-hmm.
not know whereof it is from.
Mm-hmm.
The second gift, the pre-personal gift, the fragment of deity, knows from the get-go where it was from.
Right.
And, you know, it takes on as its mission helping the first gift discover its source. And
okay,
and
so that
process...
Back up a minute. I lost you there.
Okay. The first gift, I call it an instance of God, is personality. That gift, when received in this experiential plane... By an aware creature of whatever order, be it material or supernal, doesn't matter, of whatever order, does not know its source at the get-go. It has
right.
to discover its source. The second gift, the fragment of God, when it is bestowed, it knows whereof it is from. It knows that it is of God.
Mm-hmm.
And what it wants to do is it wants to personalize.
Right,
and its
right.
best bet for personalization is fusing with this other thing that doesn't know.
Right, the creature.
The creature, the self-aware creature that does not know.
It's like the parent chooses the child, but the child is unaware of that. That will procreation, that will eventuation, but the parent knows from the very beginning whence comes the child.
Exactly. Yes.
And,
that works.
And
that works.
Even though the child is nurtured by the parent, it has all these needs that are met by the creator, it is not conscious of being given this. It is only conscious of want of need.
Right.
It isn't really conscious of how that need gets fulfilled. And as we mature, we become aware that that gift is being given from the parent for some reason, that they love us.
Yeah,
they are
that,
taking care of us.
That is the transition from childhood to adulthood. You know, and you know, throughout all cultural traditions, there's some sort of ritual that helps that along. You know, in the Christian tradition, the ritual is confirmation. In the Judaic, it's the bar mitzvah. In primitive cultures, it's the child being taken from the woman to join the group of men as hunter. Some sort of transformation takes place, where the unknowing child becomes the knowing adult, and that's the same pattern. That's the same pattern.
Yeah, I think that's true. The only difference I would say is that, I mean, I think it's unfortunate or sad or, you know, that we're losing something by not updating that ritual process.
We've lost a lot, and that explains that this whole tradition that has evolved that disconnects us from the divine, that sees life as a fall from grace, is removing us from what is real, and we need to find our way back. We need to find new rituals,
mm-hmm.
new rites of passage, new understandings. But I think we're off the air.
Well, we've been off the air for a long time, but we're not. The show is still recording.
Okay.
For a limited time, because I started late.
Right.
And for people who listen to the archive shows, they can either fortunately or unfortunately continue to hear this discussion. But my point was that in the way things are today, the speed at which we are developing, both as the whole or the collective, the civilization or the society, as well as individually, you know, the age at which children mature, the age at which children become more sentient, the age at which they learn to read or learn to think, seems to be speeding up. You know, they're doing these things at younger ages. And yet, in certain ways, the motion from adulthood, from childhood and dependency into adulthood and independency almost seems to be taking longer. So there's a bit of a question that I have as to when we would initiate that ritual. For girls, for example, they sort of enter maturity or enter puberty earlier than boys do. At what time you really start to take responsibility for your own decisions or you become more volitional, you know, can be anywhere from 6 to 25 or something. And maybe for some people, it never happens at all. But it does seem like it would be helpful to us to have some type of traditional ceremony or some type of traditional recognition that would address the issue. You know, we've also lost a considerable amount of, I think we talked about this before, of mentorship. in our current society, where there really is no one individual whose job it is to, you know, see that being through their apprenticeship process, if that makes sense. You know, the parents are not always that involved. Are you still with me?
I'm listening, yeah.
Obviously, I'm partially speaking from my own experience, but when you have a family where both parents are in the workplace, for example, where more of the responsibility for educating becomes, you know, the requirement of the state or the city or the government, as opposed to the family. There really isn't any one person who's responsible for knowing where that individual is in their maturation experience. I can look back and I can say, this was the point where I transitioned from child to adult. Or this is the point where I had my, you know, I'm the one who's responsible for the way I'm perceived. Or, you know, my acts have consequences.
Well, you know, what you say is absolutely true. And from my perception, in part, the reason for that is we do not have a story. And mm-hmm. What am I trying to say here? We do not have a myth to live by today.
Right, right.
You know, myths are stories that empower us to experience the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, they're metaphoric, they're symbolic.
Right, right.
And in the past, we have been able to take these metaphors and use them to transcend the metaphor.
Right, right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But today, we're stuck in our metaphors. We don't step beyond the metaphor to the meeting.
We have a drive for metaphor.
Well, actually,
we find it in, I guess I'm thinking, for example, of Tolkien and his
Tolkien,
the Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings.
Trilogy.
Yep, yep.
He mentions why he wrote that. It was because he didn't have a story in his culture, the Celtic culture or the culture that had been the mythology of the British Isles had sort of been destroyed or been overshadowed by another cultural layer
paradigm,
right, that covered up what they used to think, how they used to perceive things. So he created this mythology, an intentional mythology, to fill that gap.
Yeah, George Lucas did the same thing with Star
Wars. Absolutely. And look at the response that both of those paradigms had in the culture.
Exactly.
It was
this
overwhelming positive response to this mythology that gave people something to latch onto.
Yeah, the phrase we use is resonate. The story resonated to us.
And
with us,
and with
yes.
such a large number of us. I mean,
exactly.
It was unknown.
It's filling
phenomena.
An essential requirement. We need to have our story. We need to be told our story. We need to become part of our story. And for whatever reason, and I have, you know, my own sense of why it is, but for whatever reason, the poetry of myth has been transformed into the prose of the mundane.
Well, that's very well put. Kudos for that line. Yeah,
and
I think so.
And what we are wanting, in both sense of the word, you know, we want it and we don't have it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
There's two senses to that word, wanting. What we are wanting, what we want to have, and what we don't have, is the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And without it, we are lost.
Right. Right. It's a very good point. And one that I wish Paula was here with us today to engage in, because she is such a poetess at heart.
There's no question in my mind about that. She is able to, you know, I remember ICO-8 when we were in plenary session with the fellowship and the foundation and the association, and she spoke of a family that went through a divorce and is now on the mend, and the wounds are healing, but the new skin is so fragile.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
That's poetry. And we aren't stuck in it. We understand what the message is. We get beyond her words to what the message was. So, yeah, she is a poetess, no doubt in my mind. And we yearn for poets.
Yes.
Anyhow,
I thought I would dial in and fill up the
empty space in the 2 hours, and here we are
at
overtime plus 12. But
right. I'm sure we're now off the air, but thank you so much for having the urge and following and adding the momentum to that dead air. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Dave, as always.
And we'll talk again tomorrow evening with our TUF group.
Right. Talk to you soon. Have
you
a great day.
Keep that light shining.
God bless.
Bye now.
Bye.